Miss Carson, Matt Damon is here for your 1 o'clock.
Send him in.
Sorry we're late. It was hard to park the car.
It was what?
I'd like you to meet my associates, Art Farmer and Carl Fahd.
How do you do, Mr. Ford?
No. It's Fahd. Like the car. Like a Fahd Explorer.
I'm Dolores Carson.
I beg your pardon?
What are you, hard of hearing? She said her name is Dolores Carson.
Oh, Dolores. Like Dolores Hart, who was in Where the Boys Are.
She's a nun now. A Carmelite.
Mrs. Carson, I won't waste your time. We want you to do the title sequence to our new movie, The Martian.
The Martian?
It's about a guy who gets stuck on Mars.
Wicked cold on Mars, Mrs. Carson.
My character has no food. He has to start farming.
Artichokes and such like.
I'm going to stop you right now. I think I get it.
You do?
Yes. Picture this title sequence. The Martian in large letters. It's dark. But then we see the stars. From far away, we hear music from a harp. Then the credits are carved with a sharp knife like a scar on the surface of Mars.
It's as if she speaks our language.
When can you have it ready?
By March 4th.
March 4th? You better get started.
I will, but first a show about the art of title sequences. But before we get to Colin and his guests, here's Jonathan McNichol.
If you don't already know exactly where that sound comes from, my guess is you weren't a 7-year-old boy in 1985 like I was. If you do already recognize that sound, you're picturing grandfather clocks and cuckoo clocks and alarm clocks and clock radios, sure. But you're also picturing photos of Albert Einstein and Benjamin Franklin. You're picturing contraptions that start coffee makers and can openers and turn on toasters and TVs.
Officials at the Pacific Nuclear Research Facility.
You're picturing a tall pile of wet, festering Calcan dog food. It's the opening of Back to the Future that we're hearing, and it's the mad scientist Doc Brown's workshop that the camera has been exploring. With this one unbroken 3-minute shot, we know someone's obsessed with time and gadgets and machines. We know that some dog maybe hasn't eaten in days. We know that someone's got stolen plutonium under their bed, all before a character appears on screen. The thing you probably don't remember from this sequence is that it's also the part of the movie where we learn that Michael J. Fox is its star, that Alan Silvestri did the score, that Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis wrote the movie.
Hello, anybody home?
This is Back to the Future's opening title sequence. Kind of by definition, the chunk of the movie that has the credits scrawled across it is distinct from the rest of the film. So why not use it that way?
You know, I used to say it was a moving introduction, just like a jacket cover on a book.
Nina Saxon designed the titles for The Fugitive and Forrest Gump and The Gilmore Girls. Oh, and for Back to the Future.
You settled in. It reflects the mood of the movie, and it allows you to have that it feels like the movie.
It's just giving the audience a signpost.
That's Patrick Clare. He does title sequences for TV shows.
It's a little bit of an airlock, really, between living out there in everyday life and then coming back into this world the show's created. It's a chance to do something that's kind of visual, symbolic, and really get to the heart of the show, the tone, the subtext.
Back to the Future's opening is what's called type over scene. But some movies like North by Northwest or Seven or the James Bond films, do something different, something that's almost like a little music video at the start of the picture. You see this a lot, in fact, on television. Patrick Clare has been nominated for 3 Emmys for main title design. He won last year for True Detective, and he was nominated twice this year for Halt and Catch Fire and for Daredevil, the Netflix show about a blind superhero who's a lawyer by day working in a corrupt, crime-ridden Hell's Kitchen. Clare's title sequence is this almost monochromatic 60-second segment that sets the show's pulsing main theme against these simple symbols of the Daredevil world. Symbols like Lady Justice and the city's skyscrapers and Daredevil himself. And they're all just covered and dripping with this viscous, red, oily, bloody, flowing fluid.
As always, we kind of started with the story, which is the most important thing to me. So we had all these elements, some of them very literal. The goo that got thrown on Daredevil when he was a child that blinded him. And then these kind of more esoteric ideas of blind justice and insidious creeping corruption. It made sense to us we had to do something about things unseen. So we thought we'll get objects from this world, and then we'll reveal these with this kind of poisonous blood-like stuff that could then like insidiously creep down over them and have that sort of that ominous tone of there being something evil or bad in the world kind of creeping out.
You said that that story is the first thing, and I get that, and I believe you. But is there an impulse too to just make something that, you know, looks really cool?
I mean, I think it's got to look cool. That's at the heart of it. It's got to look striking. You know, it's got to grab you by the throat. when you come to a show, the showrunners spent so long working on it. Sometimes they spend months, sometimes they spend years. They know these characters inside out. They've done all sorts of research on the world. They have all these images and symbols in their heads. All this stuff that leads to really rich subtext. But only a certain amount of that subtext can kind of make it into the drama. You know, the script can't kind of deal with that directly. What I love about my job is that I get to come in and translate all this thinking someone's done for a really long time into something that's purely visual, something that can hopefully look cool on the start of the show.
All right, and we're going to talk about title sequences today. That was a lot of intro, but that was an amazing intro by Jonathan McNichol. Thank you so much for doing that, Jonathan. And let me tell you who's here. Joining us from Toronto, from the CBC studios, they're Will Perkins and Lola Landekic. They are both the geniuses behind The Art of the Title, which is it's a website which I would not encourage you to go to today unless you have a lot of time that you could spend, because you're not going to look at it for 10 minutes. I would urge you to go there on a rainy day, where if 2 hours go by, it's not a big, huge time sink for you. Because one of the things all of us have discovered is that you just can't look at this for a brief period of time. It's a very addictive website. So, but do go to it at some point anyway, The Art of the Title. Sam Hatch is with us. The minute we started talking about doing this show, I thought, well, we've got to have Sam. We should say Sam is a cultural correspondent and film critic, otherwise known as one of the culture dogs. You can hear him Sunday nights at WWUH 91.3. We're one of those rare radio stations that promotes other radio stations.
I love it.
Yeah, so... what I thought is, I think most people it just flies by them. I mean, wherever the title sequence appears, at the beginning or the end, and we'll talk about that in just a second, it just flies by. Most people couldn't tell you anything about any title sequence they've ever seen, that even the term itself may be a term of art. They really don't know that well. So we had to talk. We had to have somebody in the studio who actually pays attention to and remembers title sequences, and I knew without having to ask that that was you.
Oh, thank you.
So what's important to you about a title sequence? You know, why do you care about it? What makes you care about it?
It depends on the film. I mean, some, like was mentioned before, are just really cool looking. And even sometimes those will impart messages subconsciously to you, like something like Scott Pilgrim versus the World. That's just this blast of color and energy and music. But there's subtle clues as to some of the characters in the film that you'll only learn after watching the film a second time. But then there are some, like Seven, of course, untouchable title sequence that actually gives you an insight into the world of a killer that's off screen for most of the film. So it depends on what you're going for. Sometimes it's just establishing mood, like Vertigo, probably my favorite title sequence of all time, just establishes just a feeling of dread and a mood about it. And then sometimes it gives you a full-on, like, dramatis personae, like Snatched, Guy Ritchie's film, that actually tells you who all the characters are. So it's got to be visually interesting, possibly musically interesting, and or just, crafted well.
So Will Perkins, you mentioned Vertigo, and I was starting to wonder how long have title sequences been a thing? I mean, my sense is that if you go much further back, you start to get basically MGM presents some name of some film with some people in it. All right, let's do the film right now. You know, was Hitchcock the guy who really made auteurism include title sequences?
Well, that's a funny thing you mentioned, Hitchcock. He actually started his career as a film intertitler, a title designer per se. It was in the silent era that you started to see title sequences, but it wasn't until after sort of the golden age of Hollywood, late 40s, early 50s, when you started to see these sequences per se, these big, big animated pieces.
And Lola, is there sort of like a Vertigo... which doesn't have quite the kinds of bells and whistles that we're getting used to these days, but has, as Sam said, a very visual and kind of hypnotic style to it. It's 3 minutes long. Is that about as long as a title sequence can go?
Yes and no. I mean, we've seen incredibly long ones, 10 minutes. We've seen incredibly short ones, 30 seconds. Even shorter, something like Silicon Valley is like, what is it, like 12 seconds?
Something like that.
Yeah, so you don't need a lot of fanfare. Certainly Hitchcock really liked it. You can see it in something like North by Northwest, which is a benchmark. Those are both designed by Saul Bass. So he determined a lot of the direction of title design.
And Lula, I just want to stay with you for a second on this. So when he determined the direction of it, how did he? I mean, did he say, look, this is going to have artistry. This is going to be a statement in and of itself. It'll be in all the ways that was suggested during that intro. It'll have to connect to the content of the movie. But, I mean, if you watch, for example, that Vertigo title sequence, you know, it's a face and then an eye and then, you know, and the information is flashing up on the screen around it. And then there are these sort of graphic renderings of an iris or a cornea or something. And it gets more and more abstract that way. But I wouldn't say that you need to watch that to know anything about the movie. So what did Saul Bass do? What decision did he make?
Well, Saul Bass and in later times, him and his wife, Elaine Bass, they created a visual language for movies, particularly in the 50s. And so for something like Vertigo, it created a gateway, a door through which people can enter the world of the film. You need a moment to kind of segue from your, you know, humdrum everyday reality into this tense and, like, terrifying world that Hitchcock is going to present you with. And that's what the title sequence does.
You know, watching that, and it's 3 minutes long, and it's, as I say, it doesn't have the kinds of bells and whistles we're used to. And Will Perkins, one sense that I have is, you know, I'm not Sam Hatch. I go to the movies, and lately I've been really paying attention to title sequences, but that's kind of a new thing. But the sense that I have overall is that some of these movies, particularly some of the blockbusters like Mission Impossible and the Bond movies and stuff, they're almost in a kind of arms race. You know, it's like, oh, you did that? Well, we're going to do this. Look at this. I bet you can't do that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Especially with the James Bond franchise. I mean, you think of the title sequences for those movies. That is what you think of when you think of James Bond. You think of the silhouettes of women and the guns and the, you know, the action-packed life of James Bond. That's what you remember about the movies. You know, they sort of blend together after a while.
And so much of it is a technology. So much of Bond is about his gadgets and his style.
And the women in his life.
Yeah.
And so Sam, as the guy just buying his ticket and settling down there or walking in with his critic's pass or whatever, I assume you there's some of these franchises where you expect to be taken on a ride, some kind of, you know, thrill ride that's almost separate from the movie.
Oh, and certainly the Bond films are the highest level of that. You know that after, you know, a few minutes, a little interstitial, like, early piece where he goes on an adventure, there's going to be this break, and it's going to be a break from reality, but it's going to deliver all the kind of like trigger pieces that you expect from a Bond film. So yeah, but interestingly, lately they've been moving away from the sex as an overall like huge impacting piece in those, and focusing more on death and violence. And Daniel Craig's, I guess he's a little bit edgier and darker Bond, but yeah, so I always expect that stuff. I mean, Morris Binder's work definitely suffered through some of the 70s and 80s, and they started to become a parody of themselves. But I still love them. I mean, that's what I want to see about, you know, maybe 5 minute mark to the 10 minute mark.
Well, let's talk about what I would assume is the single biggest trend in this whole world, which is so many of these movies have moved the title sequences to the end of the movie. And I'm assuming that's because they just assume that today's restless ADHD, you know, it's either put Ritalin in the popcorn or move the thing to the end because people just can't sit still and watch something that's 3 minutes long. Is that why they did it?
I think that's a lot of it. But also when you think of the Marvel movies, you know, all these movies have that post-credits sting, that little extra scene. Marvel's been great where they've started using their end title sequences and they've built them in a really interesting way. In order to keep the audience engaged, keep them in their seats until that little stinger appears at the end of the film. But yeah, you know, I don't know if it is Ritalin in the popcorn or what, but, you know, there's just not an appetite, I don't think, with modern movie audiences.
It's also something that, like, goes up and down in waves. Like, mm-hmm. You would see a lot of closing credits in the 50s. If you go back to the 50s mm-hmm. and the early 60s, they're still there, and then they kind of fell out of favor. And then the late 90s, they kind of came back, so.
Goes in waves.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about titles right after this. All right, our theme here is The Art of the Title, which is the name of the website hosted by Will Perkins and Lola Landekic, who are two of our guests here today. Sam Hatch from the Culture Dogs here in the studios as well. This is a show about the title sequence, and it's a hard show to do, partly because title sequences are mostly visual. It's rare that things are spoken, but not impossible that things are spoken. And I want to switch over a little bit to talk about television title sequences, and I'm going to go back in the past because one of the things that has been done with television title sequences. Sometimes they're there, and Sam, you kind of alluded to this with something else. Sometimes they're there, they just try to explain to you what show it is you're watching, basically. Yeah. What's been going on. If you're just tuning in, you've never seen this show before. Here's what this show is. And sometimes if you go back to some of the old, really classic ones, they sound faintly ridiculous in terms of the amount of exposition they do. So let's listen to one.
The Fugitive. QM production, starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimble, an innocent victim of blind justice, falsely convicted for the murder of his wife, reprieved by fate when a train wreck freed him en route to the death house, freed him to hide in lonely desperation, to change his identity, to toil at many jobs. Freed him to search for a one-armed man he saw leave the scene of the crime. Freed him to run before the relentless pursuit of the police lieutenant obsessed with his capture. The guest stars in tonight's story, Janice Rule, Kevin McCarthy, also starring Barry Morse as lieutenant.
He's also allergic to shellfish. Something else will come up about how his birthday's in November. First of all, yeah. So, Will, this is one of the things that they used to do, right? It's not unheard of now. I just the other day watched a TV show called A Review, in which they basically, in the title sequence, explain what the premise of the show is. But that's increasingly rare. It's a lot of the artistry that people may have fallen in love with, starting with Hitchcock and moving on through this era of auteurism, seems to have sloshed way over, like all the other kinds of artistry, into television.
Well, it's some of it is, you know, keeping the audience engaged. So with an episodic show like The Fugitive, it's different every week. We want to give the audience a recap of sort of where he's coming from, where he's been. But you see something like that with Game of Thrones, to cite a modern example. That doesn't, narrate the opening, but it shows you basically where the action is going to be happening in this episode and who's going to be in the episode just by virtue of the locations that it visits in that location, in that map you see at the beginning of the show.
And so, Lola, when you see something like Game of Thrones, if you want to be inspired, we could play a little of the music in the background just to kind of get you in the mood. But the first time
it's very inspiring.
The first time that you saw that, did you feel like, oh, this is really new? I mean, do you have sort of moments where, as a graphic designer and illustrator and the managing editor for Art of the Title, you feel like, oh, wait a minute, we just shifted onto some new ground?
Yeah, definitely. Will and I get excited about new stuff almost every single day because people are sending us stuff in. You know, we're stumbling onto things. Something like Game of Thrones is really exciting, especially for the time that it came out, because it's so deeply involved. There's obviously such a great appreciation for the source material, and it took a giant team something like a year to put that together. So it's really admirable. It's an impressive piece of work.
I mean, Sam, as a culture dog, I assume that you're noticing this too, that whether it's the Mad Men sequence or whatever, the TV titles are just right up there with the movies.
Yeah, and that's always my litmus test is when I marathon them, am I going to stick around for the titles each and every time? Even lately, I've been flashing back to the 80s and I've been marathoning Miami Vice, and I can't skip through the Miami Vice credit sequence. So even as simple as it is and how many times I've seen it, that's ingrained in my memory. But, Game of Thrones blew me away. And every time you think you've seen it all, something like that comes out to rival what's going on in the films. And, part of it was trying to figure out how they created it. It literally fooled me into believing that they had somehow done some stop-motion work with models. But I knew innately that had to be computer graphics, but that a lot of that draw was, how are they doing this? What's going on here? And it was just a great geographical primer for each episode, too.
You know, Will and Lola, I know recently I think you interviewed one of the things that happens on Art of the Title is you guys interview some of these teams or artists or creators who make these title sequences. And as was suggested in the industry, this is in the introduction. This is now kind of an industry in itself and has been for quite some time. But one show that I've watched a lot is Masters of Sex, which is about Masters and Johnson. It really has a pretty eye-catching title sequence in which every possible sexual suggestive thing involving fruits and vegetables and animals and trains and you know, and it's and there's this the hunting kind of accordion tango music that's playing, and then that's intercut with a kind of semi-animated version of the Dick and Jane books, except Dick and Jane are a little bit older, and they're, you know, doing something a little bit more fleshly than Dick and Jane typically do. And at the end, Dick has fallen back on the bench, and Jane is having a cigarette. And I mean, the whole thing is, every time I watch it, I think I can't decide whether this is the most brilliant title sequence I've ever seen, or whether it's so on the nose and so too much. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. So, I mean, Will, how do you make an evaluation like that?
I like the Masters of Sex intro. I enjoyed the first couple seasons of that show, and I think it's sort of a really nice match to it. It's got, you know, it starts in the late 50s when things are very reserved and repressed, and it's moving into the early 60s. So it's got that great – it pairs very well with the show, I think.
And Lola, one of the things that emerges just reading the site that you guys have is – like how this is really like making a movie, right? When you interview like the people who created that or any of the title sequences we're talking about here, they're basically in the job. I mean, I keep coming back to the fact that Napoleon Dynamite was made for $400,000. I'm assuming some of these title sequences cost much more and take a really long time.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, perfect example is something like Fight Club, mm-hmm. where David Fincher had to justify a $1 million title sequence, which was completely unheard of. But if you're a fan of titles and you are really interested in setting up the tone of your project in a very specific way, there's no other way to do it.
And so I assume that once Fincher broke that, I mean, have there, Lola, been other $1 million or more title sequences? I mean, is that no longer a big thing?
People tend not to discuss the budgets of their titles very often. Yeah. But certainly we've seen a great number of, you know, titles that do the film before the film mm-hmm. approach. And very often they stand as standalone pieces. They work like a trailer even. So
you look at something like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, another David Fincher film. He's a huge title design fan and user. That would have been a multi-million-dollar sequence, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I wasn't crazy about that one, too. I felt like I was just having a lot of effects thrown at me that didn't really connect me to the material that well. But I could tell a lot of money and time was spent on it. So, Sam,
yes. You
mentioned Fincher right at the beginning.
Huge
you
Fincher
feel
fan.
Like he's sort of the guy these days. And so when you say that, I think you said Seven, his film Seven, might be, you know, your favorite ever.
Yeah, that and Vertigo and a handful of the Bond ones. Kyle Cooper put that together, and it really... That kickstarted a lot of modern title sequences, and I feel bad because shortly thereafter, Kyle Cooper apparently got jobs doing other films like Mimic, and I as a viewer, was like, "Eh, somebody saw Seven and ripped it off completely," and it was him kind of ripping himself off. But just that the creepiness of it, and just how off-putting it all is, and the style and the pacing, and how it matched up so beautifully with Trent Reznor's well, it was a remix of a Nine Inch Nails song called Closer. And just how abstract it was.
Do you want to have a little bit in the background while we're
talking? Yeah, let's play that.
Yeah, actually do that. So, and so what,
ratchet up the creepiness here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and so what we're seeing, too, is you're seeing kind of a peculiar handwriting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
the job names, like director of photography, that's flashing up in a kind of blurry sans serif script. And then this kind of creepy handwriting is writing the names.
Yeah, it's almost as if the creators of the film are being put into this killer's creepy journals.
Yeah, and then you sort of start to see his stuff, right?
Yeah, and it sets this tone that lingers in the background throughout the rest of the movie. So when you're involved in this cop procedural, and there are some horrific things that happen, most of them are off camera, and you're picking up the pieces after the fact. So that allows you to kind of steep in the killer's world and feel disgusting in your own skin for a few minutes. And that just lingers throughout the rest of the film.
And Lola, in a sense, I think, you know, you listen to that music and you start picturing those credits again, and I certainly watched them today, too. It's kind of like a running start, too, right? I mean, Fincher's able to say, I'm going to creep you out before I show you a frame of this movie. You're already going to be worried.
Exactly. And the thing that's really impressive about Seven is that it kind of kickstarted an entire renaissance of title design. It encouraged so many people to become motion designers. We talk to people like every single week, someone saying that Seven is what made them want to be a designer. And, you know, I really got to hand it to Kyle Cooper because he has a great legacy in that one piece.
So we're going to have to break here in just a second, Will. But before we do, Jonathan McNichol pointed this out to me, that I did it in the wrong order. I watched Seven, and then I watched the title sequence to Kill a Mockingbird, which is kind of the same thing in a way. You know, I mean, it's this little kid's stuff. You see the box open and the crayons, and then some pretty interesting things are done, you know, with the titles and the crayons and stuff like that. And the title of the movie is revealed kind of in a wax relief thing by playing with the crayons. But you're seeing all this little stuff. And having just watched Seven, I kept expecting some horrible aspect to this. But go ahead.
No, it's amazing. It's a very similar approach, obviously, with very different tones and intents behind them.
Yeah, and I have to think that for its time, too, it was a pretty revolutionary way to do credits. You know, it's very simple and intimate, and instead of sort of telling you, well, this is going to be this massively important movie, you're just looking inside this child's world, and you see the things that Scout is messing around with there. All right. Well, I dare not ask anybody another question because we're going to go to a break here right now. There'll be a little bit of fundraising that you'll hear. We'd really love it if you would, in fact. If you pledge during the show, we get a little extra credit for that. People think maybe there's some reason for keeping a crazy show like this on where they do an entire show about opening title sequences, which we can't even show you. When we come back, though, we're going to have more with Sam Hatch from the Culture Dogs and from the amazing site, The Art of the Title. During the fund drive thing, you might want to get your computer open, get on the site, Art of the Title, because that way you can look up some of the stuff that we're talking about. So Will Perkins and Lola Landekich will be back after this.
You know, these are the credits for a show about opening title credit sequences. I feel like we should use different music.
The Colin McEnroe Show. Producer, Betsy Kaplan. Announcer, actor, and technical producer, me, Kyone Wolf. Tweetmaster and actor, Greg Hill. Also featuring Lydia Brown and interns Nate Gagnon and Dan Schultz. Special thanks to Jonathan McPants. Introducing Lee Remick as Bill Curry. Craft services by the Faith Middleton Show staff. On tomorrow's show, Philippe Petit. And now, back to Colin.
That's right. Tomorrow, well, this is also sort of movie related because The Walk is creating a lot of stir right now. We have an interview that I did with Philippe Petit right around the time The Walk was being filmed, and he was actually sort of talking to Joseph Gordon-Levitt quite a bit at the time, or at least a bit, about playing him. So it's an amazing interview just in terms of the number of things that Petit talks about. So if you didn't hear it before, you're going to get to hear it tomorrow. Right now, we're talking about The Art of the Title. We're talking about that with, in fact, two of the founders of a website all about movie title sequence. Not necessarily opening movie title sequences, because that's not always where they are anymore. Will Perkins and Lola Landekich is with us, and Sam Hatch from the Culture Dogs also with us. Lola, one thing I do want to talk a little bit about, since you folks spend a lot of time interviewing the people who do this, this is its own kind of art and own kind of industry. I want to talk a little bit about who these people are. And one of the interesting things about this is that a high proportion of them tend to be women, right? Do you have a theory about why that is?
Well, I wouldn't say a high proportion, but I would just say that women are very well represented in title design. And, you know, like film or any other medium, any other industry, it's male dominated. Mm-hmm. For titles, one thing that we have really been trying to pay attention to is representing people other than white males in Hollywood. And there's actually tons of them. And so, you know, even someone like Elaine Bass, who is Saul Bass's longtime collaborator. They worked together for 40 years. She didn't have a Wikipedia page until this year, which we wrote.
And Will Perkins, you know, one of the things that suspicions that I always harbor, and it may be an incorrect suspicion, is that, I mean, people get out of film school or whatever, and they all think they're going to be directors, and then they wind up gravitating towards specific areas of the film industry. I mean, do you sense in talking to people who do title sequences that maybe they thought they were going to be directors, maybe they think tomorrow they are going to be a director, they're just doing this for a while, or is this something that you just get committed to very early?
I think generally, you know, these people are just passionate about film and media and television or whatever field they're working in. Some of them definitely do have aspirations to become filmmakers. And you see that with a fellow like Gareth Edwards, who directed the big Godzilla movie a few years ago. He started as a title designer. Tim Miller, who's directing the upcoming Deadpool movie, he did the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo opening. So I guess it all depends. You know, some of them are just passionate graphic designers or VFX people who love their craft, and they do a lot of commercial work as well. And it just so happens that they're offered a chance to work in titles.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the integrity. And by integrity, Sam, I mean, you know, like one problem I had a little bit with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the David Fincher American version, is, you know, it just was sort of amazing looking, but I didn't really feel as though it related me to the actual content of the movie as much as, say, I mean, this would be an example of less being more, but I mean, recently Will and Lola had Raging Bull up on their site, you know? And so that's like almost three minutes long, and not a lot happened. You get this adagio playing, and you've got, you know, you've got this sort of ghostly figure of the boxer there, you know, with the hood up and everything like that. But somehow or other, I'd rather watch that than just have a lot of stuff flung at me. How important is it to you that somehow or other there's a resonance between the title stuff and what you're about to see?
It depends on the film. And I actually feel almost opposite about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And it not only has a lot of information about the film you're about to watch, but about the entire story. Mm-hmm. There's kind of visual references to elements from Lisbeth Sanders' story and the other books as well. But anyways, but besides that, I definitely prefer to have some sort of connection to the film in one way or another. And if it enriches it, it's even better for me. Raging Bull, of course, makes me think of Taxi Driver, and just the how that scene is built, it's great. It tells you what the core of the film is. You know, it's got
Just give me a quick sense of that, because I'm not you. I don't even remember what
it's just got this languid, droning Bernard Horman score. It sounds like somebody put a 45 record on and played it at 33 and a third, and it's just kind of going. And there's this smoke billowing from the streets of New York, and this cab is slowly moving towards you, and then it quickly turns into a bunch of montage shots of Robert De Niro's eyes in extreme close-up, and then it actually shows you his point of view with these distorted streets where nothing has a solid edge to it, and then the smoke starts kind of combining with the image of his eyes. So it basically tells you that no matter how many nice dates he goes on with Sybil Shepherd later in the film, that's what's going on at the core of that film, and that character is just deeply flawed and is just creeping towards a horrible end.
So, Will and Lola, I'll ask you this. This is a profoundly ignorant question, but I mean, is this our title sequences something that you got an Oscar for at the award ceremony that's held separately, you know, that somebody else hosts? I mean, is there an actual Oscar for that? And I think I know that there are Emmys. I mean, can you win big awards for these things?
You can win an Emmy. You can win a South by Southwest Title Design Award. You cannot win an Oscar because there's no title design guilds. They don't have a posse in Hollywood that will represent them in the Academy. So there has never been a title design Oscar.
So what won the most recent Emmy for title design?
It was a film called, a television show called Manhattan, WGN America. It's about the Manhattan Project. And that was put together by, Imaginary Forces?
I want to say yes.
Yes, sorry. It's all a blur in our head. But yes, great, great sequence, very architectural sort of sketches of the Los Alamos compound mixed with sort of everyday life of 1940s family.
And it's got some touches of like Six Feet Under and Dexter in the way that it's sort of quiet and it focuses on details.
It's a wonderful piece.
By the way, as we're going along here, this is a late point in the show to tell you this, but I mean, we are live here on Tuesday afternoon. Give us a call if you have a specific title sequence that you love or you have a question about. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can also please tweet us. Our tweetmaster, Greg Hill, is there at WNPR Colin. Were you about to say something, Sam?
Oh, no, but I can.
Okay.
Speaking of new TV shows, the one that really jumped out at me recently was Bosch on Amazon Prime, and it's so simple. It's just really a Rorschach test, a kind of recreation of a mirror image, and just a split image reflected on itself of Los Angeles. And it looks computer generated at first, and then you realize, oh, it's just a simple camera trick. And I love how that establishes the mood for the series. It's got a good jazz kind of trip hop score going under it too.
I might as well give you guys a chance to do the same thing. Yeah, Lola, any title sequences on television that you're in love with these days?
Well, recently I really love *Halt and Catch Fire*, and I think that's a modern classic almost already. Just that sheer vermilion red dripping into your eyeballs. It's very strong, and that's another Patrick Clare piece.
And what about you, Will?
I'm a big fan of Halt and Catch Fire as well. That was our number one pick for the best title sequence of 2014, and it was actually up for the most recent Emmy as well, as was Bosch. But no, it's a fantastic piece, and another Patrick Clare elastic title sequence, and they've just been killing it with True Detective, Game of Thrones, the list goes on. Daredevil.
Daredevil. So, yeah, Patrick Clare does seem to be sort of dominating all this. You know, it's hard sometimes, I think, to unthread the music from the title sequence. You know, what's having the effect, and I think ideally they all work together. Will and Lola, I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about The Affair. Okay, so this is a series that's just come back for its second season. Its title sequence is a kind of montage of oceanic stuff and bodies writhing and other stuff that I probably don't even remember all that well. But the other thing that's happening is this Fiona Apple song is playing in the background and kind of driving the whole thing along. And I'm assuming sometimes music just, maybe it's always just this gigantic thing, but I'm assuming in a situation like that, music is as big as what you're seeing visually.
It certainly is. I think especially in TV, it functions in a way that it doesn't necessarily in film. In TV, you know, if you hear a theme song from the other room, ideally you'll know exactly what's playing and you'll run into that room and you'll want to watch it. For something like The Affair, it certainly works in that way. You can hear it. The Sopranos, that made Alabama 3 very famous.
But the interesting thing is a lot of the time these title design studios don't get that piece of music until very, very late in the process. So they'll be creating their title sequence to a completely different piece of music and then bring it together at the last minute.
In that sense, one thing I recommend is check out our article on Cosmos. The music that they were cutting to is completely different to the music that they finished off with, and comparing those two sequences with the different music is really interesting.
You know, Sam, one of the things that you were saying is, you know, if you're binge watching a show, it's a great test of the title sequence.
Yeah.
Will you watch it 12 times in a row as you're binge watching? But Will, one of the things that they do on television these days, I'm noticing, is sometimes from season to season, they'll change the title sequence. Mm-hmm. I was just watching The Leftovers this weekend. And in fact, they've got an entire, they've really kind of refabricated the show anyway, or rebooted it or something. But the title sequence is completely different. It's gone from this sort of faux Michelangelo, cracky kind of painting thing to something very different, much more sort of Southern and Texan. And I know on The Wire they didn't do that, but they had the same Tom Waits song performed by a different person every season, I think with Tom Waits finally doing it at the end. So in television, I assume this is something that you can do, right? You don't get just one shot.
Yeah, The Leftovers is a great recent example, and because that second season is basically a reboot for the show, they wanted to reboot the title sequence as well, and it's perfect. It's great. That's actually also elastic, funnily enough. True Detective did that as well for the second season, completely changed up the sequence, and yeah, you see that definitely season to season a lot more with television.
It certainly helps them out with the Emmys, because now they can submit again.
Let me grab a call from James in New Canaan. Hi, James.
Hi. Just calling regarding an interesting title sequence for mm-hmm. Magnolia. Long, sprawling film, like a 3 or 4 second title sequence. But in those 3 or 4 seconds, they show the entirety of the film, but it's all like super rapid cut. So you can't even tell unless you sit there with your DVD player and slow it down and look at different characters and the map of Los Angeles and everything that could pack into that short burst of time.
Wow, I know. Did you know about that?
The quick flashes of all the images of the film. Yeah, and that.
Yeah, that's kind of a common trope. Is that because you don't actually understand any of it? You don't. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get the significance until you watch it again. So it's kind of a really satisfying thing on repeat viewings.
You can see that with a film like Catch Me If You Can, Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. The opening titles, which are a great sort of Saul Bass-esque homage, play out the entire plot of the film. But of course, you're sitting at the beginning of the movie, so you don't know that at that point.
I'm also wondering how much something kind of one epic kind of sea change sets a tone for a lot of other stuff. And I mean, I could be wrong about this, Lola, but I feel as though Game of Thrones somehow influenced the title design for the new Stephen Colbert late night show. It's that same kind of mapping thing, you know, it's the same kind of long pan of a terrain with mapping. Sam, you're nodding anyway. Like, this might make some sense to you.
Yeah, I totally buy into that. If there's this kind of amazing paradigm shift in the graphics, that it's going to carry over, even if it's the same guy, being forced by
studio to kind of recreate the magic he had before. But yeah, like in the Wake of Seven, there was Kyle Cooper did some great stuff. I love his sequence for The Island of Dr. Moreau, an otherwise not that great film. But almost immediately after Fight Club came out, the X-Men, you know, pretty much did a very similar thing with, you know, close-ups of genetics and all that. So yeah, certainly Game of Thrones. I mean, you can't top that thing. So we're gonna see the ripples in the wake of that for a while.
And Lola, I'm assuming what happens to a lot of these designers is they do get yelled at by this dude. Give me something like that.
No, of course, and that's a big problem with design in general, where they're like, we want something original, but make it look exactly like this other thing.
Kyle Cooper's still in that sort of Seven
mode.
Yeah. You see with the American Horror Story title sequences, they've got that same gothic, scratchy, creepy feel, even through the newest title sequence.
It's been about 20 years, but he established such a strong visual language that it still has so many more repercussions.
People want him to do it.
All right, we're going to have to stop it here. It's been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank Sam Hatch. He's from the Culture Dogs. You can hear him Sunday nights. I don't know what it's competing with on our station, but it's on 91.3.
Thank you.
Will Perkins and Lola Landekic, they are the creators of Art of the Title. Go to that blog when you have several hours of your life that you're willing to lay down in the service of watching movie titles. But don't go to it if you only have 10 minutes and you have to go someplace, because you will be late getting there.
You know how sometimes at the end of movies they have like bloopers and outtakes and stuff, and then you kind of keep watching as the credits roll, and there might be like an Easter egg, like an inside joke, and it ties back into the movie? Yeah, we don't do that here on this show.